This is a National Museum of Australia recording. For more information, visit nma.gov.au/audio.
First of all, my name's John Harms. I'm the new director at Manning Clark House. And I'd firstly like to acknowledge the traditional owners of the land on which we meet today. Welcome on behalf of Manning Clark House and the National Museum of Australia. This is a combined effort, a joint effort, and hopefully it's the first of many that that I'm involved in over the years to come. Manning Clark House, for those of you who don't know what it is Manning Clark and Dimfna Clark's former residence, where Manning Clark wrote his six volumes of history and many other words. And when I first went to the house recently, a few months ago, I went up the steps to his famous study. And there, sitting on his desk, is a mug full of his pens and quills and pencils. And it's a mug with the crest of the Carlton Football Club on the side of it. Because Manning Clark was a mad Carlton fan. I wish that he'd remained a Geelong fan like his father, because then I would have had a lot more time for him. His father was a Geelong fan, who died just before the Geelong Premiership of 1951, I think. But football has been important in the Clark family, and the sons and daughters, if anyone knows Sebastian Clark, he is a mad Carlton fan. Mad probably being the operative word. But like Manning Clark, I love football, and I'm really interested in its social significance. So in so much as this is about football and sport today, it's also about the social impact of football, because football offers a lens through which we can observe Australian culture. And it's a very useful lens. And so too is the lens of race. Okay, Dave, do you want to come up? Sorry, this is Dave Heaton, just one of our speakers. I'll introduce them all in a minute. So too is race a very important lens and useful lens to look at issues by, especially at the moment. Now, some of you will have seen Serena Williams foot-faulting the other morning. Well, that has sparked an enormous controversy in the United States. And one of the things that I did when I went looking at the YouTube example of it, the first YouTube I came up against was a Finnish version of it, which was very hard to understand. But I then Googled a little further and came up with an American sporting site, one of these classic US-type blogs, which is there to encourage discussion about events that happen in sport. And some of it is, you know, oh, I think the charges are better than the whoever's. But a lot of it is actually really interesting to look at, because you get an idea of what people are thinking about social issues through sport. And it was really interesting to see the Serena Williams discussion on this particular site called Blitz, which quickly degenerated into an argument about race, because of course racial politics in the United States are enormous. And you know, some of it was really quite intelligent, some of it was really awful. And in fact, I'm going to mention an awful one. One poster wrote the letters NP, IP, GP, GP, EP, RP, and his post then said, take out the P's. And you're left with the word nigger. And that was the only thing that he wrote. You know, so that's the sort of thing we also are up against, that sort of attitude. And, you know, on the other side of the coin, there was a lot of racial comment. It was interpreted in a racial sense. So the lens that people were using on this particular site was the lens of race. The lens of race is very important when considering football in Australia, of all codes. And that's what we're going to try and find out today, how important it is and why it's important and what that lens shows us. I wrote a book about Steve Renoff. Now, Steve Renoff played for Mergan, Wandai, these are towns in southern Queensland. He then played for the Broncos, he played for Queensland, he played for Australia. A magnificent footballer. For those of you who are more Australian football orientated, I describe him as the Andrew McLeod of rugby league. He's famous for a moment. He's famous for quite a few moments, but there is one moment in the 1992 Grand Final which is often replayed when St George are playing the Broncos, and Steve's having a pretty ordinary game, and right near the end, he picks up the football, and he takes off down the touchline, and he's chased the entire length of the field by another Indigenous player called Ricky Walford. It's just a fantastic moment in Australian sport. It's sort of an iconic moment where you've got two Indigenous Australians with the focus of millions of people on them at that particular moment. Very important image. My book is about rugby league, but it's also about a man trying to understand his own identity, trying to come to terms with what, as he said to me, it means to be a black fella once you've finished playing football. Recently, I was taken to the centre of Australia by a photographer called Dave Callow, who is just a fantastic bloke. And I was at an art show in, here's my Friday night, was in Melbourne, having a few too many reds. I got the plane to Sydney at 6 the next morning, then to Uluru, and then got in a four-wheel drive, and for 10 hours we drove till the sun came down. And then we camped and we wound up there at a little place called Wanan. And there was an Aboriginal football carnival on at Wanan. Teams had come from Kintore, Jerkala, Warburton, all these communities, and played on a red, dusty oval, about 240 metres long by 170 metres wide, this massive, massive oval. And Dave took some photos. So I thought we'd try and create a little bit of flavour by showing you some of these photos. I'll just get rid of that, and I'll get that. There we go. Okay, so the kids would play in the morning, and after they'd play, the blokes would play. And those of you who visited these communities will know the significance of football. I think that's a magnificent photo. Look at that. And I'll let the experts talk a little bit more about the significance of the game, but there's a real sense of community in being at this carnival, and it was a great privilege to be there. There's a soccer ball. What's that doing there? No, it's interesting that Football Australia, the soccer people in Australia, have made the statement they're hoping that within the next decade or so, 15% of players in Australian soccer will be of Indigenous heritage. Fantastic photo. The boys from Kintore won. They jumped back in the Toyota and off they went. 12 hours north. Just terrific. So I thought we'd set a bit of the tone there. Now, when I was at Wanan, the coach of Jerkala came up to me and he said, "Hey bloke, you got Paul Roo's number?" And I said, "Well, I can get Paul Roo's number for you." He said, "I've got a few things I want to tell him about how to coach." Hey, block. Okay, we're going to have an informal day today. We've got tremendous speakers who've agreed to join us today and be part of it. We'll have two segments. We'll hear from two of the speakers. Oh, by the way, Phil Egan couldn't make it today. The family issue in Melbourne came up and he couldn't come. We'll be in two segments. The first one will go till about 10:45 and we'll have a break. We're free to use the cafe and so on. Get yourself a cuppa and something to eat. And then we'll come back and we'll have the second session. Our speakers are Dr. Sean Gorman, now research fellow at Curtin University. Wrote a book called Brother Boys about the Cracker Brothers. I won't give too much away. Shay Cockatoo Collins, who of course played for Port Adelaide, then Essendon and Port Adelaide, and has since done many terrific things in Indigenous affairs, worked in schools, in education at Ross Trevor College, He's been an advisor to Mike Rann and now is an advisor to the Santos Company. And Dr. David Heaton, who I'm sure is pretty well known to you here in Canberra, a cultural historian, done a lot of writing of his own, edited some fine projects. So we'll be hearing from the three of the lads today. If you have a question during the course, rather than just leaving questions all the way to the end, let's try and informalise a little bit. If you can catch my eye whilst I'm sitting there and would like to ask a question, and we also have a microphone that Adam's got there, we'll just run it more like a, you know, what's that show on TV, you know, on SBS? Something like that. You know what I mean. Now, whilst I was writing the book on Steve Renoff, on the other side of the country in southwest Western Australia and in Perth, Sean Gorman was writing his book on the Crackers. Now, we didn't know this, and Sean's book came out, my book came out, and we met at the football at Geelong on the terrace at Cadinia Park. We had so much to talk about, because even though we were 5,000 kilometres apart, the issues were so similar and the experiences were so similar, which was really interesting. So to give us some of the background to, the historical background in part, to this issue of Indigenous football, I invite Sean Gorman.
Thank you, John. I too would like to acknowledge the traditional owners on whose land we gathered on today. Just as some background to me and the project on the Crackers, my family come from a small town called Mount Barker, which is in the southwest of Western Australia, in the heart of what is Noongar country. The southwest is where all the Noongar peoples are from. Which extends just to the bottom of Geraldton or Dongara and goes to the other side of Esperance. And there's a phenomenological line of where the Marbran or the Christmas tree stops germinating. And you know there, once you start to punch out into the goldfields and further north, that is the Noongar line. So once you start going further out, you know, you're going into Yamaji or Wongai country. So the Crackers are very much from the southwest of Western Australia, which makes them Noongars. It's exactly where my family came from, and my grandmother Molly taught all the Cracker family and Jimmy and Phila in high school. She was a remedial maths and English teacher, and one day she told Jimmy off, and he picked up a duster and threw it at her, and it hit her in the side of the head. And she's a very small lady, and she made Jimmy stand outside. And as he was going outside, she said, "You'll never amount to anything, Jimmy Cracker." And I suppose she got it half right, Molly, because Jimmy did amount to something, and it was football with Philip, obviously, which enabled him to show his significant talents alongside of that of his brother. And the reasons why they were significant, there's a number of reasons, and I'll talk about those with the PowerPoint. I'll show you some footage initially. Then I'll show you a PowerPoint and to give you some sense of who the Crackers were for those of you that are too young and perhaps those whose memory has got a little bit clouded over with time. So bear with me. I will. What I want to show now, hopefully, is some footage from their very first season. Why are you doing this? From the very first season with North Melbourne, which was in 1982. Here we go. Part two. Take two. These ostensibly is the one third of a PowerPoint presentation that I've given to five AFL clubs currently, and I initially showed it at the Aboriginal All-Stars camp in Darwin at the start of this year. On the left is obviously a copy of the book, which was started its life as a PhD. I spent best part of four and a half years talking to everyone from the family in Mount Barker, the North Mount Barker Footy Club members, the boot studders down there, coaches, old teachers, And everyone right through to Ron Barassi and John Kennedy. And if you know your football, well, you'd know that those are fairly big names. That, on the 30th of May, was adapted for theatre for a play called Krakow, as you can see. Now, the reason I show you this is not to pump my own tyres up. The reason I show this is because as a white fella, as a Wadjala, as a Gubba, as a Gadia, as a Miglu, okay, and so some of you would know exactly what areas of Australia they would be in terms of making that reference. As a white fella, walking into a black fella family and getting permission is not an easy thing to do. And the reasons it's not an easy thing to do is because it comes with a history, yeah? And some of those things we'll talk about in a minute. So the reason I show this is to show that I'm immensely proud of the work that I've been able to do with the Crackers, because it is based upon a mutual trust, an understanding, which has come about through long conversations and building up trust over time. And once you have that as a starting point, there are many, many things that can happen which are great. I never, ever, ever thought I would be able to produce a book. Yeah? And now I'm on to my second book. And it's because of the permission that the Crackers gave me and enabled me to do that, I've been able to do those things, which is a great thing. So I suppose that, plays itself out in broader terms, in a macro level, not just on a micro level from my work with Jimmy and Phil and the Cracker family, but it can also work in a bigger way. Precisely what Shay is doing with Santos and advising them is ostensibly building up trust through dialogue and engagement with people who have over time, through history, have not had such great relations. Yeah? I love this photograph, and there's a reason I love it. It's because it tells a story. In 1982, when the Crackers first came to the VFL, as it was, before it was the AFL, there had never been two Indigenous players play on any one team, with one team, up until that point. With the Crackers coming to North Melbourne in 1982, this starts to change. The reasons why the Crackers were so important to North Melbourne is because they were a unit within a team. By that I mean, and I haven't followed much rugby, so I can't make the comparisons in terms of those. But Jimmy was a tough in and under rover, a foot at the pack, front and centre type of player. Whereas Philip was a sort of a will-o'-the-wisp player, wingman, come half forward player, who could work into space and generally be on the end of a handball that would come from Jimmy, who had gone in, got the ball and knew where Philip would be. A lot of people within the media at the time did not know how to engage with this. Talking to my good friend Martin Flanagan, who writes for The Age, and John's good friend also, many of you probably know who I'm talking about. He said, with the coming of the Crackers to the VFL in 1982, it was unprecedented. And the reasons why it was unprecedented, because it said it was like someone bowling backwards in cricket. No, we had not seen this type of style of football before. Nor have we seen it since. Yeah? The ways that the Melbourne media would engage with this is they would say it was simply magic, cracker magic. Talking to Steve Hawke, who wrote the great book on Polly Farmer, he says when the Crackers start to play at Claremont, which is the footage you just saw then in the Waffle, this is when the first time this type of discussion or type of language is started to be used in the West Australian in the West Australian news media. Okay, so with the coming of the Crackers, there's this change in the ways that sport reportage, starts to manifest itself within the media. Jimmy had not had an easy life up until that point. Jimmy had been removed from his home and school on a number of occasions for fighting, and I don't mean just a little bit of a punch up in the playground. I mean serious assaults, where he would be abused at school generally, or he would be threatened in some way, and the ways that he would deal with it was through his fist. He wasn't interested. Jimmy Cracker was not interested in some philosophical discussion about the names that you had called him. If you called him whatever, he would react, and he would react physically. Shorty Daniels, who played with the Western Bulldogs, said Jimmy would seek retribution out with his fists. Jimmy, when there was travelling boxing troops to Mount Barker in the southwest, he would willingly jump into that ring and fight. And there are many reasons for that, but basically Jimmy had issues with his identity and he was angry, I suppose, in many ways about how his family and his Noongar community had been treated over time, and we'll get to that in a minute. Jimmy had also been incarcerated at the age of 16 in an adult prison for rape. A year and a half later, he was spent another 6 months in jail. 3 weeks after he got his driver's licence, he was done for killing a man on a stop-go sign just on the 5 mile outside of Mount Barker heading towards Albany. Obviously, many of you would know also that when Jimmy retired in 1995, he was done for trafficking methamphetamine across the Nullarbor. And was sentenced to 16 years. He served about eight and a half years and got out. Philip, by comparison, lived a fairly sort of pedestrian life, worked for Australia Post, was like Jimmy, a solid family man. Jimmy was a solid family man. But they were very different in the ways that they would deal with the abuse that they would cop. If Philip ever copped any kind of vilification, there's also in the book, and I'm sorry I didn't bring one today, but there's also a great line in the book by Philip that whenever he would be vilified, he would say, "Yeah, I might be black, but doesn't this red ball look really good in my black hands?" as he would run off and kick another goal.
Did that happen often? Were they vilified often?
Yes, they were. And see, it's interesting, when you talk to... Oh, thank you, very good, excellent. Oh, no, you're right, I am... I normally like to have one as a bit of a safety net so I can sort of like lean on it a bit. So thank you, I'm right. Yes, they did. But throughout the course, I interviewed about 120 odd people for the book, yeah? And it's interesting, when you've got, and I'm not trying to be ageist here, but when you speak to those old school sort of hardcore sort of waffle and VFL players, they would deny that it ever happened. You talk to the black fellas in that, and they said, yeah, it happened often. So it's somewhere in the middle you've got to try and sort of deal with it. And other players, like someone like Polly Farmer, I've interviewed Polly Farmer on a number of occasions, and Polly, the way Polly would react to it is he'd say, well, you know, I haven't got the problem with my... And he goes, yeah, I am black. I am a boom, he'd say. But he'd always say that the person who had the problem wasn't him. It was the person who addressed him. It was the way that he would simply go out harder in it as a means to beat his opponent. Yeah.
The racism with Steve Renoff in the country town of Mergan was such that...
Well, I asked him about it, and he'd say, "Yes, we were abused. You know, we copped a lot of flack." And I said, "How did that make you feel?" He said, "Oh, well, that was just the way it was." You know, so there was this deep acceptance in an Indigenous person himself.
Yeah.
And that's the insidious nature of the racism at that place at that time.
Absolutely. And I talk with the holistic PowerPoint that I show, I'm more interested in institutionalised racism than actual vilification. And the reasons why I am is because that costs people their lives. Calling someone a name is terrible. It's abhorrent, but it might not cost someone their life. And the reasons I say that in terms of institutionalised racism, there's the issue where Mr. Ward, there's a fellow from the back of Warburton, some of you may have seen the 7:30 report, the Four Corners episode a few months ago, about how he died. He was simply thrown into a paddy wagon in the middle of summer, given a bottle of Coke and a frozen pie, driven 5.5 hours down to Kalgoorlie, died due to dehydration and having third-degree burns on his torso. In the back of a van, like a dog. No one has been prosecuted for that. That is not a black and white issue. That is a human rights issue that should make us absolutely furious. It makes me furious. Yeah. The other issue is with a bloke by the name of Louis Johnson, who came down and was adopted into a very well-to-do white family in Western Australia. Louis, on his 19th birthday, went out, and as you do when you're 19, you go out and have a few drinks with your mates. He was walking home one night, on the night of his 19th. He's laid down on the side of the road, just off the actual road itself. A group of young white youth were driving around the leafy streets of Kareen. They saw him there, pummeled him, all hopped out, pummeled him. Then someone had the bright idea to pull him out onto the road and run him over a few times and then drove off. A cyclist saw him a couple of hours later rang up the ambulance. The paramedics arrived, assessed him, could smell alcohol in his breath, assumed that he'd been petrol sniffing also, and simply took him home. He died that morning due to the internal hemorrhaging in his body. That makes me really angry, because that assumes that someone's life or well-being is perhaps not, it's not necessary to carry out the proper checks and balances that you and I would simply take for granted. I'm more interested in institutionalised racism than vilification. So in terms of Andrew's career, that's the son, Jimmy's eldest boy on the right there, who played 101 games with Richmond. He is also in jail now for an assault. Up until that point, Andrew had not so much as a parking ticket. So there are many, many stories that I could tease out of that, but due to time restraints, I can't go into it. How much time do I have, Harmsy?
About just 10 more minutes.
Oh, good, excellent. But in order to understand the crackers, where they've come from, you can't just say, okay, well, they've come from Mount Barker, which is 350k south of Perth. You need to understand where they've come from socially, politically, culturally, yeah? This is the Mount Barker Reserve, just outside of Mount Barker, obviously, in the 1960s. What you see in front of you is the new and improved version of the accommodation that they had on the reserve. The reserves were gazetted to be just outside of town. They were done by the main roads boards, which were very powerful institutions because they could determine where things went, literally. And so the reserve was just outside of town. In the 50s and the 60s, if you were caught outside of the curfew in town, perhaps you were in town trying to get a feed for your family or looking for a lost child, you would be put in the back of a paddy wagon, taken to the town lockup and put in jail for the night. No questions asked. The crackers remember growing up on the reserve. The crackers were lucky in one regards, because where these reserves were generally next to was the local town tip or the sanitary depot, yeah, which would lend itself to disease and a whole range of other problems which would arise due to being in those places. Where the crackers were was next to the railway line and the sale yards. There was no running water, there was no electricity. And Philip's got this, once again, Philip's got all the good lines, because Jimmy hardly talks. Jimmy's a very quiet man. Yeah? Philip is the jokester, he's the raconteur of the family. And Philip's got this great line. He'd say, yeah, well, if the cows didn't keep you awake at night, the sheep would keep you awake. And if the sheep didn't keep you awake, the train rattling past at 1, 3 and 5 in the morning would wake you up. And that's the way he dealt with it, yeah? Ironically, the place that they called this, the local Noongar community, they called this place Hollywood, which is a lovely little sort of irony, and the ways that they dealt with those things, yeah? It's a nice little montage. At the top there, we've got the North Mount Barker Footy Club, as you can see in the third road to the second, third from the right is Jimmy. It's interesting, Jimmy is standing in a classic pose where he's got his thumbs in his biceps, pushing him out, but his eyes are looking like that. They're looking somewhere else, yeah? They're looking to a future, whereas everyone else is looking forward. Philip, down in the front little row there, I joked with Philip about that because I said, you're looking over at the pie warmer, aren't you? He said, yeah, I was, actually. To the right here, the crackers, when they first made state football together, when state football actually meant something, yeah? And obviously down to the left there, the qualification in terms of what Cracker Magic means, and that Spooner, the Spooner cartoon, when they first came to have this mental telepathy, yeah? And the ways that they would engage. When I talked to Jimmy, I talked to him about the magic. I said, tell me about the magic, Jimmy. And he'd go, what are you talking about, bro? And I'd say, well, you know, how would you be able to, like, you know, find one another, you know, you'd have 10 blokes around you, you'd get the ball out and you'd hand the ball off and it'd plop into Philip's hands, he'd run off and kick it off. I said, how did that happen? He goes, well, we had the ball from the time that we were 3 years old, when we could walk. We'd go down to the park, we'd be constantly handballing and kicking, doing all these sorts of things. It was just confidence. And there's another great story within the book where, like, I suppose in a Bradman-esque kind of way, whereas Bradman would be up against the water tank with the stump and the golf ball, Jimmy and Phil had practiced their handball when old Eric had come back after a hard day's shearing. He'd be sitting down having his tea, and Jimmy and Phil would be over the kitchen table, over the dinner table, trying to get close to old Eric's nose. That's how they practiced, yeah? So there's all these wonderful stories within the family and around the town of Mount Barker about the ways that the Crackers enabled their style of play. However, when they did hit the big league, Lynn Onis, many of you know who he is, a very famous Koorie artist, and this shows, I suppose, the paradox, the irony of being a high-profile Indigenous footballer in the 80s in the VFL. Phil Cracker kicks a goal. Grouse, amazing magic. There's that word again, yeah? Phil Cracker misses a goal. Stupid black, dumb coon, useless bungs, animal. Okay? Now, I suppose, once again, that shows you the sort of knife's edge that they were on. When Jimmy or Phil played well, how they were respected and how they were engaged with by the people in the crowd. And when that didn't come about the ways that they wanted it to what would eventuate, yeah? And these sorts of things today are also abhorrent to us, but the reason for that is because of the ways that the AFL have come in with their Rule 30, their racial and religious vilification laws, and the ways that these sorts of things these days don't go on, or they don't go on as much as they used to. And the thing I've found, when someone says something stupid at the football these days, three or four people around them will tell them to pull their heads in, yeah? Whereas that would not have happened 10, 20 years ago. I think it's a great thing that the AFL have been able to do. Just the last couple. This is a very important document, and there's a reason why this is a very important document. This is back in 1987. The VFL were responding to an 11% drop in attendances in gate receipts. Now, there were reasons for this. There was decentralisation of clubs, talks of club mergers. The VFL, as a suburban competition, was going... Well, there was talk of this national competition, the AFL, yeah? And people weren't liking it. And what you normally do when you don't like something, you vote with your feet, don't you? You walk away. This is what was happening. The VFL at the time absolutely crapped themselves and said, what are we going to do? Ah, yes, we'll make some advertising. Now, the reason why this is a really important document is not necessarily because of the little slogan up there of take the family to see some Aboriginal art tomorrow. It's actually the ways Jim and Phil are framed. You've got that social kinship responsibility of the elder one protecting his younger brother from potential harm, yeah? Philip's waiting for that ball to pump up into his arm so he can run off and go and kick another goal on that deadly left foot of his. However, the reasons why this is important on another level, on a historical level, is because this is actually an inversion of the realities that Aboriginal people face more broadly within Australia. In this shot, the Crackers, or black people, Indigenous Australians, are the playmakers. They're the ones in control. Yeah? In reality, it's the inverse. Yeah? That's why this is important, because it enables us to view the time differently. Yeah? Really important. And it's also the first time, also going back to Steve Hall, it's also the first time that I know of, in the research that I've done, where two Indigenous Australians have actually been the centrepiece, the showcase of a national push from a advertising perspective. Yeah? And that is it, I believe. Yep, yeah, that's that. All right, apparently...
Yeah, just cue it up and I'll ask Sean a couple of questions, or we might even throw it open to a couple of questions. The Crackers, though, Sean, weren't the first, were they? Who were some of the other Indigenous players, saying, going back to the 30s, who were publicly visible and had an impact?
Pastor Doug Nicholls, Joe Johnson's recognised as the very first Aboriginal player to play senior level. There's some discussion that might actually be another fellow by the name of Albert Pompey Austin, who played two or three games for Geelong back in the 1870s. But that was before the VFA came in, so on and so forth. So there's, you know, a number of bit of conjecture about that. Pastor Doug is probably the big one, and the reasons for that, Pastor Doug Nicholls. Pastor Doug Nicholls' story is an amazing story for a whole range of reasons. But Pastor Doug goes down to Carlton in the 30s, the height of the Depression. He's living next door to a creek line. Goes down to Carlton to get a gig. get a Guernsey, and the trainers refuse to touch him, and they refuse to give him a Guernsey because of the fact that he may smell up the Guernsey, and they didn't want to have to launder it. Many of us, through that shame and the ways that he was treated, would have simply walked away from that game and gone in and played on a more amateur level. He sucks it up. He goes down to Fitzroy, knows no one. Places his Gladstone bag down. In walks Hayden Bunton Sr. Hayden Bunton Sr., by today's standard, is probably like Gary Ablett times five. I'll qualify that by saying he wins three Brownlow medals, goes to Western Australia, wins three Sandovers. He's a super, superstar. Yeah? He walks in, he sees Pastor Doug standing there, he places his Gladstone bag next to Pastor Doug's, and the statement is therefore made that this man is my equal. Yeah? Norm MacDonald was also in the 50s, played for Essendon, captained Essendon for a couple of games, I believe, which was kind of unprecedented at the time. Polly Farmer, obviously, the big cat, amazing, amazing footballer, introduces, you know, those long raking handballs to break up the game well before the 1970 grand final, when it sort of becomes de rigueur. There's a whole range of players, but they can probably be seen, or I would argue that they need to be seen as pioneers within their own rights, yeah? Because you don't have the cohorts that you have today, that we see today, in terms of those things.
Sure, can I ask, so it's the kind of appearance of the Crackers that leads to this notion of a black style of football. Is that the key moment in terms of what, you know, of even people within Australian football, or indeed without... Is that the key moment in terms of the style?
Well, I'm reluctant to kind of say that because it looks like I'm sort of pumping up the Crackers because I've worked with them, and I don't want to sort of give that impression. But this is the first time that the media start engaging with it differently. This is when the public start to, who don't follow North Melbourne, start to go to the games. I've recently just come back from Melbourne, and I've had so many conversations with total strangers. Once they know who I am and what it is that I've done, they've said, "Oh yeah, well, I was a Hawthorn supporter, and I went along to a Sunday match to watch North Melbourne play whomever, and I didn't even go for those sides. And the reason I went is because of the Crackers. Hmm. I wanted to see them, and if they didn't want to see the way that they played, they wanted to see Jimmy react. They wanted to see that, yeah." So it's the first time we see a kind of a large-scale kind of engagement on another level, which enables that conversation to start, yeah, which takes a long. So then you start to see Nicky Winmar pointing at himself, you know, obviously Shay's ex-teammate Michael Long and all these sorts of things. You start to see the engagement, the discussions that we have on a national level start to change.
It's kind of interesting if I can quickly say, because when you look at league and union that I'm more familiar with, it's the equivalent, the only equivalent we have, even though you can talk about individual players, yep. Is the Ellis in Union. Is the clear where you're talking about a particular style and a particular impact through a particular kind of play. And in their case, of course, running is three, yep. Which they used to say was unstoppable.
Yeah, absolutely. And then I've had, once again, a lot of discussions about the Ellis and the Crackers and those sorts of things and the comparisons that we can make. So
What we might do is sort the DVD out for after the break.
All right.
Yeah, but in the meantime... Because now would be a good time to introduce Shay, because Shay's the next generation of players following the Crackers. So, but before we do, are there any questions of Sean Gorman that you might like to ask? Anyone at this stage? Yeah.
Like, how were they received at the North Melbourne Football Club? Were they, you know, did North have sensitivity to them, or, you know, because they were sort of, you know, the first brothers. So.
It's a good question. At the time, North, and having spoken a lot and built up a relationship with Ron Joseph, who recruited them to North Melbourne, they really had no idea at the time what they were doing in terms of welfare and well-being, and no club really did. And even talking to someone like Malcolm Blight, you know, when Malcolm Blight came over from Adelaide, you know, they basically, you know, they couldn't actually get things like basic things like accommodation sorted out for someone like him, yeah? But when the Crackers came, I think they basically had a hole that they needed to fill in terms of their midfield, their following sort of division, and their forward line sort of makeup, and they fitted that brief to the T. Yeah. But in saying that, whenever there were issues with Jimmy and Phil, whether it was accommodation or whatever it may have been, you know, they were onto it really quickly, North Melbourne, and they really were a pioneer in terms of those things. Yeah, but a lot of clubs at the time, in terms of recruitment, actually had policies And I've got lots of anecdotal evidence of this, lots, where actual clubs would not want to recruit cohorts of blackfellas because they didn't want too many of them in their side. Now, that by today's standard seems a bit odd because you think, my God, how would Port Adelaide go? How would Essendon go? How would Fremantle go? You just don't have that sense. It's a sensibility. It's a mindset. It's a worldview that you have to change. And I suppose the Crackers did that through their playing. With the Crackers at North Melbourne, they won, playing together in the same side at the same time, they won 64% of their games. 64%. That's huge. And that's the reasons why John Kennedy would get really frustrated with Jimmy if he did react, because he wanted him in the scene, being the consummate team man John Kennedy being. You know, those would be the issues. But, you know, Jimmy wasn't going to back down, and therefore that's why he did what he did. But, yeah, 64% is a, you know, that's gold. That's money in the bank, mate.
That to answer a little bit, or to answer the question from my perspective, my uncle in the early 80s was recruited by North Melbourne, and so I'm starting already, so... Michael was, you know, we grew up in Cairns, from the families from the Cape York, Old Mapoon, and Dad's from Cherbourg, which is Steve Renoff's country as well. So, but we grew up outside of Cairns, and then Uncle Rob played football. My Uncle Michael was the pioneer in our family. So every time we go back home, obviously Uncle Michael says, well, boy, you're going to give me some royalties for starting us off. But to answer that question, I remember Jim coming, flying up, and you're right, he doesn't say a lot, but he came up with Ron Joseph, who I still think is a player manager.
He's a director at North Melbourne, but he's heavily involved on North Melbourne on many levels.
Yeah, and I remember Ron and Laurie Dwyer, and Laurie's son ended up playing with North in the late 80s, early 90s, I think. So, and I just remember Ron, the character just stood out because all of these little black kids were around Ron. And Ron, he must have children of his own because he did this one trick where you're smoking a cigarette and then he flips it around, but he ended up doing it and burned his tongue, and so you go and he's all and all these little black kids are going laughing. So I remember Ron well after too. So while I was playing with Essendon, he wanted to him and Dennis Pagan at the time wanted me to come over, and never did, of course, but we always remember that time, and he still remembers that one time when he came up. So the linkage is very important. So, and I think my uncle Rob, who ended up going down south and living in Moonee Ponds, would not go without Uncle Rodney, his older brother. So, but I mean, Uncle Rodney never ended up playing for North Melbourne, but what he did, he played for Brunswick, but was there to support Uncle Rob. And unfortunately, Uncle Rob just had this major injury that just prevented him from playing seniors. And every time I run into Dennis, he says two things. And one of those, if you would have come over, son, you would have won two premierships. And I said, yeah, okay, Dennis. And the other is your Uncle Robert is the best player never to play seniors. So, and that, you know, makes me feel very proud.
That issue of separation that you're talking about with your uncle, in the Renoff case, the big question for Steve was, can I actually leave my country? Can I leave my family at Mergen? He described it as the tearing of flesh. Brisbane's only 2.5 to 3 hours away, and yet, in his mind, it was a world away. He just wanted to be a good player in Mergen. You know, it didn't worry him. He didn't have to go and show off down in Brisbane, no. But Brisbane wanted him so much because of what he could do with the ball. Maybe now's a good time for you to take it away, Shay. Do you want the lectern or from there? Whatever you like.
Okay. Yeah, well, to open up these notes. You've done me in, Sean.
What was that?
You've got a PowerPoint.
But you've got a 60,000-year oral tradition to draw on.
Very, very good. But what I wanted to cover before I went into a little bit about what I've done and about life before football is to focus on the language and linguistics surrounding Aboriginal people in AFL. And what you'll find is it's a representation of what's done in the wider society. All right, so you'll get people, you'll get commentators using language like, oh, this is magic. So almost in a mythical sense, so which really irritates us players, because what it does is saying to everyone else that somehow this is done a lot easier, and so we don't work as hard. These are the messages that the subtle messages that are sent by using language like that. So one of the tasks that we need to do, or challenges that face us at the moment, is reframing the language surrounding Aboriginal players. And what you'll find in the wider community, as well as the reflection, when I say reflection of the wider community, you will see in language all over that Aboriginal culture is almost mythical. So you'll see, come see some Aboriginal art, and rarely is there recognition of a living, current living culture. And this should irritate all Aboriginal people, but as we were speaking last night, Aboriginal people are not actually one group. There were over 200 different dialects, and for people who probably can't comprehend that, it's more like going to Europe. And so you've got lots of different languages, and you've got dialects that you're able to link in between, but distinctively different people in different areas. And what colonisation had brought with it was a Western views of that. So now we use state borders, and these have detrimental effects on things like the environment. So you'll see the River Murray being coming from living in South Australia, coming from Queensland, certainly don't understand. We get the real bad effects of state legislation, particularly in this in the River Murray sense. So that's another thing we have to challenge ourselves with. What John's asked me to talk about really is about myself, and so you get a better perspective of what I haven't called you doctor yet, but Dr. Sean. I grew up in I was born in Brisbane, grew up in Red Hill, right next to Bronco Land, so I am very mad Broncos fan from way back. Moved to Cairns. The family moved to Cairns before I was five, really, and wanted to bring us up in a nice area, comfortable, so kids could run around. So we grew up outside of Cairns in the Northern Beach. Through that time, you know, got a lot of the demographics or the differentials in race is huge from anywhere else. I mean, Cairns, North Queensland, you feel comfortable being an Aboriginal person because you've got a lot of other black faces around you, so you've got a lot of people that you have many things in common with. So we grew up in on a beach, started playing football. My father was an extremely good rugby league player in North Queensland, from Cherbourg. So he's a big 6'4" centre, sort of like Eric Roth in his time, but played more of a playmaker's role. He always wanted me to play for the Broncos, and I always wanted to play for the Broncos too, but that never happened because, and I'll give you a story, he was an umpire or referee, as they call it in rugby league, at my very last game of rugby league when I was 12, 13, and this one kid bit me. So I turned around and I got retribution with my fist and just hit the kid back, and which was a bad thing to do in any case, but what Dad did was send both of us off, okay, and for the rest of the match. And I told Dad on the way back home, well, I was sooking all the way, and then he said, "You're right, son." I said, "I'm never playing this game again," and I never did. So, but he's fine with that because I mean, now these days he just he thinks the Super League really ruined everything for his rugby league. And he's only just started coming back, watching the game. But that's where my mother's influence, she always took me to games. Dad was pretty big in the Aboriginal health sector, so he worked all the time. And so Mum and Granny and Grandad took me to my games every week, every Sunday morning. I even remember playing 4 games one day. I loved football that much. And there was nothing else. For me, nothing else existed in the world except the Carlton Football Club and football and AFL.
Who were your idols then?
At that time, I liked Kenny Hunter. That was in the early 80s when I first... Because really, exposure to the AFL was minimal in Cairns, and that's all we got. We only got Richmond, Carlton, maybe some Collingwood. But then again, like, our jumper was Carlton, so all I saw was navy blue and white, and that was true for a very long time until I played against them, and that certainly changed everything. And for those rugby league fans out there, it's like they're the Manly of the AFL. I think they own the VFL or the AFL. But I've still got a soft place for them. But that's where it was a family outing. So the grandparents, Mum and Dad, and the younger brothers, cousins, we all played together for City United Football Club. And it was just a day out, a picnic. Kids were very tired after, so playing 4 games, not too bad. Went to sleep fairly early. Oh, I think I was a hyperactive kid as a youngster, so I've burnt out by the age of 28, so that's why I talk so slowly these days. But parents split up, the family split up in 89. It was just a huge, hugely traumatic for me at that time because I was 13, 14 going into that age where young people, you either choose, and life is about choices and making the right choice. And, you know, always thought 13, 14, 15 is that time where a young boy can either go this way or go the right way. And moving to Adelaide at that time, I simply didn't want to go. I was going to stay with a next-door neighbour, but... end up following Mum and the twin boys and Jasmine to Adelaide, and certainly the best move that I've ever made. So we did things very, very difficult. So, but what kept us going all the way was that Mum made the right choices for family. So it was always what's right for family. At every stage, and just what happened. We grew up in Port Adelaide zone, Port Adelaide, the working class suburb, and just went to a local footy club and just asked for a game, and bloke wanted to put me in ruck. I said, nah, not a ruckman, but I played full back, and then bang, that's the end of that. So then that club was, Port Adelaide's got many amateur junior clubs around its zone where a lot of history of great Port Adelaide players have come through, and the dynamics have changed since the Crows and particularly the Port inception into the AFL. So that landscape has changed forever, because like the SNFL is now known as the second best competition outside the AFL, but for many, many years, SNFL, VFL and the WAFL were very, very level. And they used to have a competition, the Premier's competition, where the Premier's for each state or each sanctioning, football sanctioned body, played against each other at the end of the year, and, you know, Port won a few of those, and they found out, and their aspirations were to become to be involved at the highest level. And for those who know the politics of the Crows and Port, and I see a couple in the room. This is why Port Adelaide do not like the Adelaide Crows. So on last weekend was a terrific, terrific day. I cried as much as watching the Obama speech. But they're the politics that I take with me. But the next generation, they won't. Hopefully, they won't take those politics with them. So we moved to Adelaide, played at a local club.
So what year was that show that you first went to Port Adelaide?
That was
to play at Port Adelaide
in 89.
Yeah. So how were you accepted in the club? Was there a sense, was there an awareness of your heritage, and was that something that came up?
Yeah, that's a terrific question. Port Adelaide has had a very long and strong history with Aboriginal people, particularly from the west coast of South Australia. So Ceduna, Port Lincoln, the Burgoynes come from Port Lincoln, even though, you know, they say that they come from Darwin. Mother comes from Darwin, father comes from Port Lincoln. They're probably just wanting more land.
But can I just ask, and when did Port Adelaide start to give attention to that? Like, how much before you were they attending to that and thinking about it and actually intentionally trying to bring, blackfellas from various parts of the kind of west and north to the club?
There's probably no secret to it other than you have to earn your spot. Okay, so what it did was separate a lot of Aboriginal players did miss out because they didn't. I remember under 17s pre-season, under seven, and I was only 16 at the time. You do 10 100s, 10 200s, all the way up. And so what it did that first day where you've got like 200 boys just wanting to play for Port Adelaide, it just separated them straight away. So so the mechanism that was in place sort of sifted out a lot of people who may not have desperately wanted to play AFL footy or football for Port Adelaide. So that's why you get good players coming through all the time, because of that system that's already existing. So that's why it seems. It certainly is the inherent and cultural right of Aboriginal people to own, to be in control of certain things like a health system. But in this situation, Aboriginal people just did what was in place to, like any other player, to work really hard to get a spot on the team.
And was there stereotyping? Because Steve Renoff would say that when he was a young, capable footballer, he'd go off to representative footy and they'd say, you're a black fella, you're a winger. You know, because that's where the black fellas play. And that was the assumption that was made. I mean, that's been challenged enormously in recent times, over the last decade. Were you subject to that sort of stereotyping?
Look, no. I was a wingman, but I love playing wing, because that's a position that I just want to play. John Cahill taught me his way of playing it, and that's the way I've always played. But when I moved to Essendon, I was put in the forward pocket immediately. And it had never sat well with me for the 5 years I was there. I except for a couple of games and one game in particular, I played in the centre, and that was, you know, or in the midfield, and that was the Anzac Day, the first Anzac Day match, and that was my aspiration to play a significant role in the team. So yes, stereotyping does play a big part, and still does play a big part the ideology plays a big part in a career of an Aboriginal AFL player, because you know people just for some reason don't see people as being accountable, all of these things, and that's a result of what their upbringing is. So I think the best advice that I could give to the kids in the room is you guys have to know yourself first before you can, so you're able to challenge assumptions, common assumptions made by other people towards your mob, towards our mob.
When you went to Essendon, was the Essendon Football Club more conscious of issues, these sort of issues, than Port Adelaide was? What was Essendon like?
Look, I think it was a work in progress. I mean, Michael, who would have known Michael's impact on...
Michael Long.
On Australia, let alone the Essendon Football Club. His impact is more significant after... you know, post-career rather than when he played. But, I mean, players just want to play, and so they're task-orientated and really don't want to worry about what lies universally, at a universal level. So all they want to do is, okay, I'm taught to get the ball, I'm taught to shepherd, I'm taught to work at a game plan, and I'll stick with it because they're my mates. And you've got this camaraderie that's infectious. And that's what I think Aboriginal people bring to a football club. It's not just the player. We were talking last night. It's what people bring with them is a more holistic approach in regards to family. So, and families win premierships, okay? You'll see... most clubs, most premierships are won by teams that have a really good feeling amongst each other and work to what we call, a lot of viewers hear the term game plan, but the game plan is really a format that the coaches say, well, here you go, let's work with it. What works, though, is, and what has always worked in Aboriginal society is, okay, the clubs will say... players, you're the team. We have what we call an MOU an agreement in place where we say these are the standards that we are going to live by, and most families have them. And you say, well, how do we want to be seen as a football club? And so Josh Carr for Port Adelaide might say, well, I want to be known as a tough team. I want to be respected. Say, okay, that's fine. Well, let's now analyse, what does tough mean? Does tough mean retribution with your fist? No, it means hard at the ball. And when it's your turn to go back, you go back. But you need help. So, so for instance, if someone, say you watch footage after, if someone goes back and pulls out, they'll be asked the question and they'll go through the team rules. Well, this is what we agreed to. You said we wanted to be tough. This does not set our values. This is not part of our values. And they'll analyse the footage properly. The person behind his other teammate should have called him back. And that would have been in the rules anyway. So, but it's a work in progress. It's how families evolve. It's how families stay strong. And that's what's come into football in the last 5 to 10 years.
So you, on that note, was Burgoyne Brothers instrumental in contributing to Port Adelaide's premiership?
Yeah, well, Port Adelaide is from its inception, a lot of players have played together in the under-15s and up. And for those who didn't play together, they would have played for South Adelaide or Glenelg or some other team. So you'll get Wilson, Treadray, Bonds, Wanganines, myself. We all played under-15s together for Port Adelaide, and the other players played for the other teams in the SNFL. To get that, and you'll never get it again. That's what I think wins premierships, because it's just something that can't be measured. It's your relationship with someone and knowing them, the way that the Crackers played, you know.
Jay, we need to go to a break in a minute. We'll get you to come back afterwards. But just before we go to the break, a nice point to finish might be, you mentioned Michael Long and the impact that he had. Just give us a few minutes on what you think that impact has been. What has Michael Long done in a social sense? And how did he do it?
Michael Long simply asked the question and challenged the norms of society. And to hear what you said before, Sean, that is terrific. I've never been on the outer before, hearing somebody say you know, some bad language. But for people around to say, hey, pull your head in, that's the type of change Michael Long's made.
So how has he done that? What did he actually do?
For one man to put himself in that light, for the nation to see, is so courageous. So what Michael did was almost sacrifice his career so that now the Buddy Franklins and even the other players from different cultural backgrounds are able to play on a level playing field. Now, we wouldn't put up with it at work, and for all of these young men, this is their work. And the type of change that Michael's made is just, it can be measured, but there's just, I think that'll be a story in itself, so I don't know whether you're doing a thesis on that.
Can I just make a very, very quick point in terms of that? That's right, it changed. It's one thing to say you're professional, it's another thing to actually be professional 100% of the time. To vilify someone is not being professional. The MCG, therefore, and all the other stadiums that play AFL across the country now, cease being just spaces where a game is played. They become a workplace, and that's the reasons why it's very important. The other reasons why it's very important, I had the great thrill of actually being in the club this year doing the same PowerPoint presentation, the longer version there. And I said, how would it have been if we didn't have that Rule 30 in, that racial and religious vilification laws, when those planes went into, and on September 11th, how would that have been for someone like Bashar Hooley? And I had Bashar Hooley sitting, I could have touched him. I said, how would that have been for your family, Bashar? And he said, we wouldn't have been able to go. I wouldn't have been able to play. Yeah? So that's the reasons why it's important, because it's for everyone, not just for black fellas.
They have fun.
Yep.
But this is a key element, isn't it? His visibility. The fact that here is a... Yeah.
Shay, could I ask, was the Michael Long impact, and as you say, for someone not kind of utterly integrated into Australian football, and I fit into that category, the Michael Long cultural, social impact has been enormous. Did that need the Nicky Winmar extraordinary moment? How important was that? Has that been overstated, or was that moment a critical moment in what's occurred in the last 10 years?
Just before you answer that, just to explain the Nicky Winmar moment, was at Victoria Park...
I know it, surely.
1993.
Okay, sorry.
Nicky Winmar had been taunted by the Collingwood mob during the course of the afternoon, and at the end of the game, he lifted his St Kilda jumper up and pointed to his black skin.
Round 4, 1993, 2 years before the vilification law came in.
If you want to see a picture of it, it's only tiny, but it was in John's article in the Canberra Times the other day, but it's just a tiny little picture of it, but yeah, go on, mate.
Shay.
I think it came to a head, I think, at that day. There was... Nicky, what a superb player, especially in 93, just dominated and could win a game off his own boot. But what it did was, you know, sometimes at that stage, Collingwood had gained a reputation, or Collingwood crowd had gained a reputation as not being the most friendly. for those who... But the move away from Victoria Park had a lot to do with that. All right, so it's a parochial fortress. I think the intervention from Maguire and his crew after McAllister reign, they're talking about the Collingwood presidents, really, really changed something. And their values had changed since. So they've got a lot... there's a lot more Aboriginal players in the team. And that's not the measurement, but the measurement is now, how do we see Collingwood? Do we now see them as that crowd that racially vilify everyone? Are they... And that no longer exists, in my opinion, anyway. So that changes can be made. It's just... I think it was at a time. I mean, Prime Minister at the time, Keating, brought up the topic or the issue of reconciliation. So it's in the early 90s. This is sort of how the landscape of Australia was changing.
We'll hear more from Shay after the break. We'll hear about what he's been doing since footy's finished, his footy career's finished. So if we take a break now and reconvene here at about 11:15, remind me too, is that because we're recording this, when we're asking questions or making a comment, if you could remind me to make sure that we get the microphone to you, otherwise it doesn't get recorded. So it's not just for an audio thing so that we can hear everyone, it's actually so it can be recorded as well. We're going to start with Sean, then we'll talk to Shay a little bit more, and then we'll bring Dave in. So, Sean, yep. Take us through some of this cracker footage.
All right, I've got probably about the best part of 45 minutes here, but I'll show you just a few little snippets of the. This is the second game that they played in Melbourne when the bloodstained Angels, North South Melbourne, had come down from Sydney. They'd moved up to Sydney, but this is their first game back. Arden Street, the story that Eddie Maguire told me, and so obviously it's true. Eddie Maguire told me he was a junior statistician for the Herald Sun at the time. And when the Crackers, that was probably about 7 minutes into the first quarter, they kicked 7 goals between them within the space of about 5 minutes, and a hush fell over the ground. And the reasons why is because the people didn't actually know how to react. Okay, so I'll just show a bit of that, and hopefully we've got a bit of sand.
Pass out the Cracker. That's Jimmy Cracker fine for the goals. A beautiful shot, and Jimmy Cracker's put it through. North are 14 points, and the Swans 22 points. There's a chance for Tanner. He could. There he goes. Jimmy Cracker again. Watch him have a go at those goals. It's a good pass. What a goal again.
Tries two. Neither successful. Reece Jones over the head of Wright. Not good handball. Cracker again. A kill to Jimmy.
And again by Dempsey. And there he goes. That time it's Phil Cracker. Up there towards Malcolm Blight and Carter. It's Malcolm Blight having his body.
They're doing it well, North. They're backing up well as McCann tops it over there to Phil Cracker. And watch this bloke go again. A running shot for goal by Phil Cracker. It's a goal. Oh, what a play that. Long kick. up there towards Cracker. He's got it. That's Jimmy Cracker again. Kicks the ball back there. Ah, that could be a mark if they're going to pay to Jimmy Cracker. They've given Ackley and Taylor four more to bit of a Jimmy Cracker. He's three, a hand pass. Now it's intercepted. They've gone. And what a tackle that time was by Jimmy Cracker.
15-metre penalty. Oh, that's a can't do that.
And they're nearly a free kick. They're all got Jimmy going after the bloke that went after Phil. Nice stick, I'll tell you what. Ball back into play again, down towards the forward pocket, going after it now is Phil Cracker, hand pass back to his brother Jimmy. This looks dangerous. It could be a goal. It is a goal.
McCann got the ball down towards Jimmy Cracker. The quick hand pass across to Hodgman. Hodgman goes towards goal and brings up his fifth goal. And Gary Dempsey takes it, gives a hand pass towards Phil Cracker, really coming into the things in this term. Cracker goes goalward. A beautiful looking kick by Phil Cracker.
Madden tried to get it down, but stolen by Cracker. Which one's this? Let's have a look at Jimmy. What a kick by Jimmy! What a kick!
Lifted his game and played a brilliant third quarter. There's a hand pass coming from Good out to Phil Cracker. Phil Cracker onto the right foot. He's down into the left. Open goal! Phil Cracker!
It overruns goal. There's Jimmy Cracker going out there. What's he got?
Left to right. Here's Phil Cracker. Shrugs the tackle well. It's a free kick downfield. I think he got flattened after he got rid of the ball, and Jimmy comes in to remonstrate, and the two Crackers are in the thick of things.
Sensible play. Oh, and look at him go with a hand pass. Over it comes down to Phil Cracker. He's looking for the goals. He's found them. Donnelly knocked down to Phil Cracker. A snap at the goals. Will it make the distance? Will it bounce? Let's see what happens. It goes through. A goal. Goal number three to Phil Cracker.
The skipper goes goalwards. The handball is to Cracker. The 30-metre handball. The blood. Ball in the goal. Puts it through. And goal. Four goals to Malcolm Blight. So two to bring up the century.
And he's kicked it. They're coming from everywhere.
The distance next section is when Jimmy hits Mark Harvey, and that's the last tee. And I just want you to see how quick Jimmy's fists are.
Jim Cracker built a reputation as a fiery customer, as Essendon's Mark Harvey discovered.
Still going to it.
While this bump by Ross Glendinning on Bill Duckworth enraged Bomber fans.
Billy Duckworth copping it from Ross Glendinning. Beautiful work. But anyway, that's that. Thank you for your patience.
Thanks, George. Anyone who thinks that football doesn't take courage to play, it's just it's consistently testing courage. The Argon. Thanks, George. Back to Steve Renoff just for a second. There are many different types of player, whether you be Indigenous or non-Indigenous, and the type of player Steve described himself as is he a player who loved playing the game. He was a real performer, what he could do with the ball when he had it in his hand. So as a young player, he couldn't give a stuff about defence, you know. He didn't care at all. He acknowledges that. And it was, it was Wayne Bennett and Tony Curry, actually, the football rugby league player who helped Steve learn that it wasn't just about his performance, it was about, you know, what the team result. And that was just Steve, you know, that was Steve. And but in his performance, as you could see with the Crackers, there's a certain balletic beauty and aesthetic to it that gives people a great deal of pleasure. Now, Shay, you're still a young man. You know, you're only, what, 34?
Yes.
So it's probably a little bit difficult for, maybe I shouldn't be asking this question because it's more you sitting in your slippers with a pipe and reflecting on 70 years when I ask you this. But what do you think, when you look back at the way your life's gone so far, and I'm sure we're going to hear a lot more of you in the years to come, what has footy done for you?
Certainly, yeah. Always reflect on the position that I am in now with my family, and I've got three young boys, 10, 6 and 2, and it is true what they say, that they are the terrible, terrible twos. And my wife, Delvine, the position that we're in at the moment is things are just fantastic. Life, work-life balance is perfect, and what football's done for me is has taught me how to deal with other personalities. I've always wanted to meet new people and learn off other people, professions, understanding, and my friend Caroline, I hope she's still here, understanding what leadership really is, and of course just wanting to play it. It was just living your dream. And as I said before, football was the only thing that I wanted to do. And Carlton, but that's another story. What it has done is enabled me to, for a young lad, whether you're black or white or whatever, you walk through a door and you walk into a foreign environment, whether it's work, whether it's a football club. From coming from that position to where I didn't speak, I'm what you call, and anyone done Myers-Briggs? Yeah. Okay, well, I'm an I, so I'm not an E, so I'm not an extrovert, I'm an introvert. And, well, at least that's what the Swiss tell me. I think I assume it's a Swiss-born thing. But it's allowed me to want to do different things in my life. And when I have a look back, and the patterns are the same. And when we talk about an AFL player, an Aboriginal player, players don't play for themselves. They play for their families. They play for each other. So what you'll see, rather than goals, even though it's great that Buddy Franklin kicked 100 goals, maybe the reason why we haven't had more Aboriginal players kick 100 goals is because I can speak for myself that I'd like my teammates to feel proud of themselves. I'd like my brothers to feel proud of themselves. I wanted my mother to feel proud of herself. So first signing up for Essendon, fantastic. Most of my money went to mum, because we had lived in such a in a poor state. When I say poor state, financially. So that was a great relief. And I heard Michael O'Loughlin, the 300 gamer for Sydney Swans, say exactly the same thing. It's all about your mother. It's all about your family. And there's lots of thanks goes to those people.
Tremendous interview, that, wasn't it?
Oh, he just sort of, hey, that's me, you know. And that's the same for Michael. It's the same. What it is, it's a way out of poverty for most Aboriginal people. So you get the opportunity to pay your parents' bills, because I remember we used to do it from week. So fortnight to fortnight, because mum was on a single-parent pension. And I remember every Wednesday night at 9 a.m. is when we got paid. So at 9 o'clock, on the mark of 9, went down to the ATM, and then we had a feed. And I think for people like Michael Long, Michael O'Loughlin, and a lot of these boys that are in the back here that want to play NRL or AFL... That's what a terrific feeling to make your the people around you happier.
Just in a couple of minutes, you've started to bring that happiness to Indigenous lads in your post-footy career. Tell us a bit about Ross Trevor and then what you're doing now.
I was approached by the local member who's to say, oh, look, Ross Trevor, which is an exclusive... Catholic College, independent college in South Australia, foot of the hills, black and white, Essendon, for those Essendon supporters in the room. Luke Darcy is a product of that, Ben Hart. They had, there's Sporting Chance initiative from the federal government allowed schools from all around Australia to, in very much the Contaff model, to establish a what we call a sports academy for different schools, and really you could mould whatever way you wanted to. So at the end of the day, we got 30 boys from all over Australia in between the ages of 15 and 17 to school and board at Ross Trevor College and just complete their SACE, really. Now, we said it was a sports academy, but it was really academic-based because what we found is there are a lot of different... the literacy rates were different for different people. Some of the boys could have just easily walked into Ross Trevor College and done well without much mentoring, but then a lot of boys really needed our assistant. So what we did was we just created a program that allowed as easy as it could be, transition from, whether it be from a remote area or from Darwin, to this foreign environment. And they won after 10 or so years of not being able to beat Sacred Heart. They end up beating Sacred Heart for the first time in a long time. And that, you know, only have four or five players from the sports academy, but the school and, you know, even I thought that I knew everything about my own culture and other cultures. This really blew our mind away. And so there's... So Ross Trevor now has 16 boys coming through their SACE, the year 12, and it's the highest of any school in South Australia. So, look, I'm really proud of that. I was approached by by Santos before I started at Ross Trevor, excuse me, and to do something similar, but they've moved into a new era where the good corporate citizens is a focus, but understanding that inclusiveness and of Aboriginal employment, or rather Aboriginal engagement, has to be a core responsibility, just like safety, just like environment. And that's why I'm employed. So really what I do is, in a nutshell, employ people, employ... create a system that that changes the value of Santos from being just a company that drills a hole, brings oil and gas out, sells it overseas, sells it to the States. Now we're talking about creating pardon me, an alliance, very much the same way as the Jewish community have set up business. And what I mean by creating alliances, if there's an Aboriginal-owned drilling company, well, then we'll use that company. But we have to, pardon me, have to as obviously meet the same safety measures as all others, because, you know, safety is a real issue. Death is the... Thank you. But at the end of the day, saying all of that, it's about changing the culture of Santos as a business to be able to say to themselves at the end of the day, in 20 and 30 and 40 years' time, you know what, we've moved ahead of the times and we're proud of our company for that.
Are there any questions of Shay before we move to Dave?
There was a question... outside was, well, where did you get cockatoo from?
Good question.
Yeah, well, there's a few Cherbourg people in the room and they obviously know where Collins comes from, and that's my father, Les. But cockatoo is my mother's surname, Frances Cockatoo, and that originates from my great-great-grandfather in Cape York just being known as Old Man Cockatoo. And when his son, my grandfather, was taken to a mission, he was given a Christian name, so John Cockatoo, and it sort of just followed ever since.
I'm interested in a question to Shay, how the young footballers who come to the big cities cope with the changes in cultures that they do experience. The example that I'm thinking of is Liam Jarrah, who's come down to play with Melbourne. And after being very homesick, his whole community is now behind him, and using the notion that he's down there on Walpiri business. And he featured, I think, on the 7:30 report last week. And the symbol was him walking along St Kilda Pier and, excuse me, drinking a skinny latte and saying, what bigger change could there be? So how is that young man or boy similar to that? How is he going to cope with those changes in cultures that he's experienced during his career?
Well, what we did at Ross, Trevor, is we just didn't pick the boys up and put them into a system. What we said was we engaged in community and families, and secret is to get to the mother. All right, if you get the mother's approval, well, then everything should be fine. So a lot of what we did with those communities is we needed support from them. So, this, you know, we had problems prior to John and I moving to Ross, Trevor, because a lot of parents would be ringing up, or the kids would be there and saying, oh, I miss home, because they'd be boarding away from home. Oh, I miss home. And the parent would say, yeah, I miss you too. We had to change. We had to educate them on language use, because that was detrimental. And that would just assist in the boy becoming even more prone to homesickness. So we said, you have to use language like, you're fantastic, you're making us proud, keep going, achieve your goal. And so that sort of changes the perception of why, or for him, why he's there, why he has to achieve it. For his people, he has to get through. And everybody, even I did go through, I wanted to go home for the first 18 months, every day for the first 18 months, and all of a sudden, bang, it just clicked, oh, I'm here for a reason. And that reason was when I was a bit ashamed at first, but my grandfather used to walk around Cairns with his Akubra with my Essendon badge on it. Oh, granddad. you know.
Just Liam Jarrah, for those who don't know, he's from Yuendamoo, which is 350 kilometres northwest of Alice Springs. And he is a phenomenal talent. He has just great athleticism and ball sense, and I think we'll see a lot of him in the years to come.
Yeah, and that's... And the reason why I've got to say, agreed to come is, well, there's no payment, I can tell you that. But what interested me in John's approach is all of the time we... like the wider community says, oh, how good this system has been for Aboriginal people. Now, what my mob look at and can see quite clearly is the use of language. And John's framing of why we're here today is how Aboriginal people or Indigenous people have enriched football. Now, that use of language is different. And for those who know the truth about the origins of this nation, people, and you don't have to be Aboriginal to understand that either, but you can see it quite clearly that this is, you know, he's obviously a good man, and I don't care what you say about him either, Sean. So we've got to, again, straying off the question, we have to be intelligent enough to understand and reframe the question, or reframe the our labelling of what's good for what.
Just before we get the microphone there, great.
Just following on from what you said earlier, both you and Sean, when you were talking about language and the thing with magic and all the rest of it, I just wondered if you noticed with young Liam that he's called the Walpiri magician now? Something like that, or wizard, or the Walpiri wizard. So, I mean, that's still sort of self-generating and still going on. Yeah.
Well, in terms of that, in terms of what Shay was talking about and you've just mentioned, to really drive this point home, if you go onto that wonderful thing YouTube, and you Google Cyril Rioli tackle on Max Rook, I was at Melbourne Uni last year, and I was teaching the students, and they were having this real difficulty with magic in terms of it's not so much its political correctness, but how it was ideologically fueled and framed, yeah? And I was battling constantly, week after week, we'd always come back to this notion of magic and how I was perhaps too oversensitive to it and all the rest of it. I said, but it's not inherent. The things that perhaps are, you know, Shay is able to do, or Michael Long or Jimmy Cracker, is not necessarily an inherent thing. It perhaps needs to be sort of developed over time in a social situation. And then the moment came when Cyril Junior Boy Rioli took down Max Rook, and the commentator's first terms of reference were, "It's in the blood." Now, if you don't believe me, go to YouTube and check it out. It's in the blood. So I then went, when the next lecture was on, I said, right, if you don't believe me that this is not part of the lexicon and it needs to be reworded or reframed, bang, and we hit it. Because none of them remembered it because, you know, in the play, it's just surging constantly. And that was a particularly interesting piece of play. But it made the point very, very clear that the ways that we look at this thing, engage with it, how we frame it, we need to hit the pause button and say, well, what is actually being said here? Who is speaking and what are they saying? Yeah? They are the two questions we need to be asking ourselves.
Because it does separate the skill and the ability from the individual. Absolutely. You know, it distances, whereas really, that's it.
And takes away from the time and the application, the hours of training and application and dedication that go into that. It's not just something that's,
And it perpetuates myths as well. Exactly. So, but what it does as well is it almost defames an individual or disenfranchises it. So you get this perception within the system that's embedded in the system that when you go for your next contract negotiations that they're always, oh, well, it's always a selective perception on a particular player, and not that money is an issue, but it'll always be less. It'll have an effect on further negotiations down the track, you know. And that's not fair. And to ask the question, where, you know, if you analyse a maturity chart for an organisation, you'll find that organisations who are serious about inclusive policy, that they'll have Aboriginal people in specific roles. And like I asked the question, where are those coaches? Where are those board members? Where are those commissioners? And as much stick as the NRL have been given over the last few years, I mean, they've actually got a commissioner, an Aboriginal commissioner, Gordon Tallis. You know, and how come we don't? And by putting people in roles like that, you change the landscape, you change language, and you'll get people challenging. Well, why did you say that? It's not in the blood. Well, what do you mean by saying that? But unfortunately, there's no one at that level. There's no one at Channel 7, no one at Channel 9, Channel 10. The only one which I watch for the entertainment factor is Martin Brooke on cable, and that's for the Gilbert McAdam factor. It's fantastic.
Yeah. But that's true. I mean, if you look at the backgrounds of the commentators who are bringing the code to us day in, day out, the type of understanding they have of Indigenous issues is such that they resort to those really simplistic and well, sometimes divisive approaches.
But it's like when you hear the term walkabout. I always stop people when I hear that term. I say, what do you actually mean by that? And when they're referring to an Indigenous person. So, because what does it allude to? Inconsistency, irregularity, unreliable. They're all negative. There's nothing positive about it. And it's all wrapped up in this neat little kind of, descriptor, which actually says more about us than it says about the person it's talking to. And these are the things, the pause button, pause it, what are we saying here? Because those words mean things. Yeah? There's a lady over there that wants to ask a question.
Sure.
I was just wondering whether the problem with language is not the language per se, but the fact that Indigenous concepts have no word in our language for them. And so we use words that have negative connotations, not necessarily meant, just because we can't express an Indigenous concept in our language.
It's like dreaming. The concept of dreaming, you know? A lot of non-Indigenous Australians, their only concept then of what dreaming actually means is, you know, wrapped up in this notion of needing to, you know, dream or daydream or in this sort of, you know, netherworld. It's not that at all. There's no... Blackfellas don't refer to it in that way. They refer to it in another very specific sort of language-based situation which is tied up into the land, their connections with one another, and a whole range of other things which have no bearing on this... on that dreaming side of things.
We need to move the discussion to Dave. We've been talking a lot about AFL. Dave's going to talk to us a little bit about the other codes. So, Dave, take it away.
Thanks, Alex.
That'll be your mic.
OK.
All right.
Here we go. Thanks, John. Following Shay, I know what that's like, must be, you know, in Chicago to be following Michael Jordan or something. A tough gig, but it's an interesting... John asking me to participate in this. I've been thinking about it for some many weeks, and the first thing I'd say, especially in light of just such terrific papers already, or at least commentary and the questions from the floor, there are significant differences between Australian football and the history of Australian football, especially, I'd say, from the 50s and 60s, particularly focusing on, as we've been discussing this morning, events, moments over the last, say, 20 years. They have generated, quite appropriately, big conversations. I'm here to say, and might throw things open for some good questions from the floor on this too, that rugby league and rugby union are different. When one grows up in, or grew up, as I did, on the northern beaches of Sydney, it was a wholly different thing. Certainly you never thought for a moment about Australian football, VFL. It was only cricket in summer, and as it was for if you were from Victoria or wherever, and then in winter you were playing footy, which for those of us with the sort of, I guess, the sort of homogenous kind of moments in the Menzies years and those years in the 1950s and sort of early 60s, you were thinking of football in terms of rugby union and rugby league. If you came from working class suburbs of Sydney, and I was there for the first 6 years of my life, the western suburbs in Concord, then it was rugby league. If you moved to the northern beaches, as my family, one of the inspired decisions of my youth from my mother and father, we went to live in Newport, then it was rugby union instantly, even though I tried to keep rugby league going with the team and played with a few of the guys that finished up playing for Manly. It was different. You never thought for a moment about VFL. Now, I'll come back to that. But given that Harmsy asked us to respond to the notions of how we have our football, generically, enriched by the Indigenous input, I won't be particularly politically correct for a few minutes by way of providing a few personal anecdotes. But just before I do, I thought you might be interested. One of the jobs that I have, committees that I'm on in Canberra, is on the ACT Place Names Committee. It's worth noting, as I checked with our main lady, Lorraine Bayliss, a couple of days ago, to isolate on the nomenclature in Canberra, in the national capital, and what Aboriginal people... sports people, which ones have been recognised in the naming in the national capital. You might be interested to know, by our best count, there are 12. They are very quickly, and I'd love to talk a little bit about them, but haven't got that luxury today. Robert Beaufort Diner in Gordon, boxer, Aboriginal leader, died in 1963. We've got Jerome Place in Gordon, the suburb of Gordon. That's Jerry Jerome, the boxer and horseman. You've got, of course, Doug Nicholls, recognised as much for his earlier background, as for being Governor of South Australia and his later distinguished career, as well as his footballing days and sprinting days. You've got Cousins Place in Ngunnawal, Jimmy Cousins, one of the 1868 originals. Johnny Muller is recognised. Muller Place in Ngunnawal. Armat, the Armats of the Darwin area. In Ngunnawal again, there's an Armat street recognising Michael Armat, Aboriginal sportsman, you know, basketballer, etc., etc. in the 60s. Then you've got, interesting for me, Johnny Taylor. Johnny Taylor was one of, at times, three Aboriginal men in a touring cricket team run that was organised by William Davis, one of the cockies in this area, in the 1850s. So that's well before the 1860s tour. And Johnny Taylor was reputed to have hit the cricket ball the furthest in the Australian colonies to that point. I think I'm right in saying, I've got to check on it, that he's buried in the cemetery at Tumut. But Johnny Taylor was renowned in this area playing for the Ginninderra team. So there's a Taylor Street in Ngunnawal. There's Samuels Crescent in Ngunnawal, namely after, of course, Charlie Samuels, the great sprinter, the man that held the world record for the 130 yards in 1888. Paul Coe Crescent needs nothing, named after Paul Coe, involved, of course, as lawyer, political activist, coached a number of All Black teams. You've got Stanley Tipalura in Tipalura Street in Ngunnawal, recognising his contribution involved in Tiwi football, of course, and also won a seat in the Northern Territory Legislative Assembly in 1987. Bobby De Monga, another of the locals in the 1850s, 60s and 70s, was, using the white term, married to Queen Nellie Hamilton, the so-called last, quote, full-blood Ngunnawal, one reads, but that was Queen Nellie. Extraordinary woman in the later part of the century, but her partner was Bobby Hamilton, Bobby De Monga, so there's a De Monga court in Ngunnawal. And finally, Charles Perkins Circuit. Needs nothing further glossing from me. So one can only speculate what we're going to be getting in the future. I was thinking that, you know, undoubtedly a Cracker Crescent, if not a suburb. McLeod Mountain, Mundine Mountain, you could go through, Sailor Street, Sandow Street, Corowa Crescent, and, of course, Shea Cockatoo Collins Concourse. We've got much in front of us. But on a rather more serious note, and to pick up on a little bit of memory and finally get round to league and union and maybe try and tease out very quickly some of the differences between those two codes. I'd like to be able to say that I could say anything particularly intelligent in terms of the round ball and the world game, but maybe that too can come out in question time. So I'll concentrate on rugby league and rugby union when I know a little bit more. I said I'd start with a couple of anecdotes and not wholly politically correct in the case of the second one, but it leads to my main point, and that is to pick up on the enriching of rugby league courtesy of the Indigenous input, and they are very significant indeed. So two memories. One was growing up on the northern beaches of Sydney, it was the case, by the best memory that I can sort of bring to bear, is that I had never been introduced to, met or engaged with Aboriginal people whatsoever in my earlier days, all the way through to playing football in my case, being born in 1950, in the mid-1960s. The very first occasion, and I do remember that vividly, was when we'd won a knockout in the Manly area, so we went to play in the middle of Sydney, and we were lucky enough to get through. I think I was about maybe 15 or so. And I'll never forget that, because we played a team and they came out. We were still in our old sort of high school jumpers. They were in the South Sydney Strip, which was, to say the least, intimidating. And I think all but perhaps three or four were blackfellas. And while the score was 5-2 in the old terms, that was one try and one goal their way, that seriously flattered us. I do remember I managed to sort of stagger a field goal to get what was then 2 points, but we were overwhelmed, and it was a real introduction, and we had a bit of a yarn afterwards. So that was number one. Number two, more significant to my sense of significance and the enrichment process, and that was I was lucky enough to go school teaching in the early 1970s, 73, 4, 5, at a town south of here that we know, those of you from this area, Batlow, the Apples, etc., etc., and that was Group 13 football. The Batlow Tigers, then things have changed. In fact, there is no Batlow side now, but that's another story. And I was playing group football and hadn't played league for a lot of years for the reasons that I outlined, but was really delighted to be playing again, or at least the town. You know, it was just the cannery and forestry and football. That was it in Batlow in the 70s. And so I started playing, and I was rather large, but nevertheless a 5'8". And the inside centre was a guy called Willow Longbottom. Now, Willow Longbottom, very much of the Longbottom mob, Kevin, of course, probably the best known in rugby league, who played for South Sydney. And but I knew Willow well. In fact, we really did hit it off. Not just because we were, you know, I was inside him and I used to just feed him all day. That's all I had to do, watch him do the business. But he was also it was one of those interesting cliches that I want to get back to in the context of Chicka Ferguson, John Ferguson, a Canberra Raider, in that there was surrounding us not only the kind of language with which Willow was treated then, and I don't have to go into it, but it was, you know, you're black so-and-so, in a kind of affection the team, but I was always struck by the fact with Willow, and I'd heard that, in fact, he'd had a number of fights at the stadium, in fact, on good authority, yeah, we've talked a bit about it, so he'd actually been a semi-professional, perhaps even a professional boxer. But we had him at, he said to me he was 37, and that seemed around about right. But there was always that notion that he was a lot older than that. But, you know, the black fellas are eternal, you know, they go on, they can keep playing, and all we white fellas always speculating on their age, and that would affect, or at least be one of the elements to do with Chicka Ferguson. But it was certainly true of Willow. The other thing about it was, I was really struck by the fact playing with him, he was about 5'10", but he was about 9 stone in the old term, wringing wet. Really light, you know, and thin arms, and that doesn't necessarily, and I don't think I'm drifting into cliche here, but he did have thin arms. And when we play, I couldn't understand the fact that there was never any race commentary. And this went for most of the first season. We finished up making the grand final, defeated, that's another story again, but nevertheless it was late, and we were playing a very big side. In fact, we were playing Holbrook, and it was about 10 minutes in, and I remember they had a really big forward pack, really big, much bigger than us, and one of these forwards, huge, he was kind of 16, 18 stone, old terms, and he made some comment to Willow. I think it might have been the Black Sea. And I saw, I happened to be reasonably close, but I saw a punch, such as it was in my memory, travel about 6 inches, and this fellow dropped like a stone. I've never seen it before, anyway, other than the occasional boxing match, dropped like a stone. I then knew straight off why you never had any race comments about Willow, and in fact then I got to talking about a number of the players, and including Willow, but he never sort of received that kind of treatment. But it was a singular lesson, and I will come back and make a connection in terms of, I'm afraid, punches and rugby league, but it does go to one of the areas of enrichment, if I can still use that term, and I think I can. Punches in rugby league and rugby union sometimes do get sort of brought into a kind of a mythological realm. If you know anything about rugby union, you might be aware, and I used it in a book that I did a few years ago called The Best Ever Australian Sports Writing, but one piece on a punch thrown by a rugby union footballer, Steve Fernane, on a Welsh prop became known as the punch. But that's the kind of thing you do on occasion get in terms of the mythology of these two codes. And I'll go one further. If you have to pick or isolate on defining moments in codes, and how much better to be talking about, say, a moment that involves Nicky Winmar, but nevertheless, this one's an interesting one. And it was a defining moment for rugby league football. And it did involve an Indigenous player. That player, I'm sure he's at least is known to some of you, if not most of you, and his name is Arthur Beetson. Roma man. Now, the punch I'm talking about there, well, you might even say two, occurred in a match in July of 1980, the very first State of Origin game. And you need a tiny bit of, and I'm conscious of time, Harmsy. I know I've got maybe another 7 or 8 minutes, is that all right? And those of you who don't know league, and I'm tempted to say that usually when you have gatherings like this where you're going to talk seriously in big conversations about race and football, you can count on the fact there'll be no people who follow rugby league in the room, or in fact probably rugby union, and mostly be from Australian football. I'll return to that point. A little bit of background, and this is from Hugh Lunn, a classic article that I used in the anthology that tells you enough, I think, and I've just truncated a sort of 7 pages to a little bit. Okay. You need to know this to understand the Beetson moment. There was a time when Queensland dominated these matches, talking about kind of Queensland playing New South Wales in the old days, 40s, 50s, 60s, dominated these matches against the more populous South throughout the 1920s, the first half of the 30s and the early 40s and beyond. The myth built up then that we were better. This is Hugh Lunn writing. Of course, he's talking about being a Queenslander. After that, New South Wales won more games, but Queensland went close enough and won enough to kindle the memory sufficiently. Mum still talks about how big Mick Madsen was in the 30s, as big as three men, and so do others. It's quite possibly in the Collins household that you heard a bit about these as well. However, and this is the key moment, and I remember it well, some of us in the room might, by the early 1960s, New South Wales got poker machines, and their rugby league clubs became rich. If a Queenslander played well in the interstate game in his maroon jersey, the next year he'd be in Sydney and near enough to certain playing in New South Wales light blue. It suited the New South Wales clubs. It caused a lot of resentment here. Being beaten is bad enough, but being beaten by your own men has a ring of betrayal about it. It is not surprising, then, that the Queenslanders accepted the nickname for the New South Wales teams as the Cockroaches. Thus began, writes Lunn a little bit later, an almost unending sequence of wins for New South Wales. Out of the 60 games since 1962, Queensland won only six. We cut to 1980. But deep in the heart, writes Hugh Lunn, there's always been the belief that we were better. After every loss, the cry always went up, but what if we had Arthur Beetson instead of them? After all, he's a Queenslander. Well, you can't get much more Queenslander than being from Roma. And Beetson had played 11 straight years for Australia and was captain. And a lot of other names were strung together as well. Now, writes Lunn, that argument has become a reality as he starts to talk about the moment, the key moment, when Arthur Beetson runs onto the field. Cut from there to one other bit. This is actually in the King Wally. There aren't very many good books on rugby league players written by people who can write, I'm afraid. But certainly this is one of them, Adrian McGregor's. Obviously I've got one to my right who can write, but nevertheless there aren't many and he knows that well. It's fantastic that we've got the pool. And this one's better than most. Certainly say the other one, the Des Hasler, Tom Keneally book's worth a look. One last little bit to set the scene. The Queensland team was not so much selected as arranged because the crucial player was to be Arthur Beetson, now 35, who had played for Australia from 1966 to 1977. McAuliffe, the senator, sought advice from Parramatta coach Jack Gibson. "I need fellows who you'd want in the trenches with you when the going gets tough," said McAuliffe. Gibson advised the senator to see Beetson personally. "If you get a commitment from him, he'll probably give you the greatest game of his life," said Gibson. McAuliffe had great respect for Beetson, not just as a footballer, but as a magnetic personality, a leader. "He'd have been a tribal elder for sure," said McAuliffe, referring to Beetson's aboriginality. Beetson ran onto that field, and as history, or maybe even mythology now says, threw at least two punches during the game. One was on a St George footballer called Graham Wynne, and the other, rather more famously, was on his former teammate from Parramatta, one of the legends of the game, as, of course, Artie Beetson was himself, and that was Mick Cronin. They were serious. Queensland won the game, and State of Origin, as we now know it, a phenomenon unto itself, has emerged since 1980. Without doubt, State of Origin, in that new concept in 1980 and beyond, could have collapsed very quickly, but the Beetson moment was crucial. The other moment I mentioned about John Chicka Ferguson. Chicka had played in other clubs but came to the Canberra Raiders and fortunately ran onto the field for the Raiders' second grand final. They'd played in 1987 against Manly unsuccessfully, when in fact Cliff Lyons, wonderful Aboriginal footballer, was the player of the match, got the Churchill Medal in 1987. We were not the best team, but we were getting a sniff. And in 1989... having had a modest season and emerging into the semi-finals, not considered to go anywhere, the Raiders found themselves in the grand final. What's more, they found themselves in a grand final where Balmain looked as though they had their measure. Memory tells me, I haven't read that for a while, I think it was 12-2 at half-time to Balmain. And so we're moving towards the back end of the game. Now, as it happened, I was in the American state of Mississippi. I had calls from about 2 a.m., through to about 7 a.m, 8 a.m, telling me bit by bit about what occurred in the last moments of this grand final. It has gone into folklore, quite rightly, but there's one component part of that game, and incidentally it was Tom Keneally who, in a sense, first publicly said the greatest grand final ever played. That's pretty much universally recognised now that it's the greatest grand final rugby league's ever known. And what happened very late in the game was that the Raiders coming on with young unknowns and a few veterans and a wonderful player called Mal Meninga as well, that they were despairing very late and the big kick went up. Now, that kick was taken by Laurie Daly, come back to him in a moment, and it was shuttled out to John Ferguson on the left wing. Chico goes off the left foot once. Now, of course, he could have gone straight and he would have scored in the corner. But then Mal Meninga would have had the kick, and he was the old down toe poke kick, you know, the thing you never see now, from the side. And God knows, even though he's a good pressure kicker, it would have been a 50-50 bet. Ferguson goes off one foot, second foot, burrows, and scores, as you might recall, you Canberrans in the audience, about 15 yards from the sticks. It was a defining moment for the club. It was certainly, in the context of that grand final, the key moment. And to the extent that you could say that people are now recognising it as the greatest grand final, then you've got another Indigenous player. Interestingly, if you're reading the Canberra Times, only a few days ago, a couple of the journalists were saying that they've lost track of Chica. Now, that's one that I might follow up. And it's, as I say, it's only surfaced in the last few days when they've had a few of the legends in town from the days gone by. But it would be interesting to see where John Ferguson is. Nevertheless, they are the two. However, and I'm only going to go for another few minutes and then, because I think questions might be interesting on this and throw a few ideas out there. League can be particularly unsatisfactory. One of the things, and I was trying, rather than sort of in a sense do research on this, if you've followed rugby league as I have for many, many years, you would know that the Indigenous element has always been a little strange. My experience of playing for the mighty Batlow Tigers in the 1970s, to some extent, schooled me into what is still the dominant mode in rugby league, and that is, there isn't any overt pride that's allowed to come through by the administrators, but it's probably equally fair to say that up till recently, opportunities have been few and far between for the Aboriginal players, and there are many now, as we know, in the game. It's intriguing that arguably the two most significant rugby league footballers in recent times to have an extraordinary profile. One is Anthony Mundine, and we might want to pick up that, you know, Mundine in question time, now Muslim, very much a personality that in some ways is affected by Muhammad Ali, you could put it no other way, who has taunted wide audiences, has been and intentionally and confrontationally and fascinatingly, so that the rugby league community has had to come to terms with Anthony Mundine. And the other is Arthur Beetson. Beetson's always been a often quietly very proud man. In recent, probably about the last 10 years, has started to emerge and talk about his Aboriginality and start to shape, in reasonably low-key ways, rugby league's response, quite different to the Australian football response. But I said it's unsatisfactory, and it continues to be so because you're still, with rugby league and union, talking on occasion about skin colour or who's black fella and who's not. And it's interesting to me, I haven't gone any further with this and intentionally, but I noted, and some of you might have seen it if you're following rugby league, that in a best ever rugby league team recently, Laurie Daly was placed in that side. Now, I've got two Laurie Daly biographies at home, and I went looking for any evidence in those biographies of Daly as a black fella, and found none. Now, I only say that because it's almost it seems to me to be in some ways typical of the rugby league experience that there is that there's a struggle to articulate the way in which Aboriginality can be and one's Aboriginality or indeed that element in the code can be expressed. Australian football still is very much ahead in that. But even that might well have to do with the fact that players are coming from all sorts of parts of Australia, whereas it's a much more restricted group for rugby league. We might pick that up in question time. My last couple of points. As I looked at the history of Aboriginal players in rugby league, and I should quickly say that Colin Tatt's wonderful books on race and Aboriginal people in sport, on occasion, as I think those of you who know Colin's writings, he makes calls on people's Aboriginality that haven't really helped any kind of positive way forward in this with this question. And I mean, Mal Meninga and his so-called Aboriginality from Colin Tatt's is an example. But also, even when he's talking about historic elements in moments in rugby league, for example, he talks very confidently in a couple of his books about two Aboriginal players in the first North Sydney premiership winning sides in 1921 and 1922, George Green and Paul Tranquil. Well, Andrew Moore's superb book on the North Sydney rugby league football team indicates with the best evidence available that neither man was Aboriginal, and he talks a little bit about that. But that's the kind of thing you do get in league, and we hope that we will get more information and we will be able to kind of, in a sense, talk it in a much more rich and open way in the future. OK, I said I'd finish, and I'm going to do exactly that. I couldn't help but look at the players who've emerged pretty much the same, if I can say, as Australian football. In other words, a first emergence in the 1960s of players coming in increased numbers, and then you start to see those numbers picking up in the 70s, 80s and 90s. And what sort of categories, and geez, I've got to be careful of stereotypes here, but what sort of categories would I put a few of the players in? And I thought I'd just name a few in my last moments. First, in terms of types of players and the Indigenous players, I would name a clutch of wonderful backs, centres, who had a particular gift. And you get this term in league a bit, you do a bit in Australian football as well, sort of ghosting through a gap. There's something special about players, and black and white, who have a capacity to sort of drift into space in a way that you think it's not possible. If I were looking at the Indigenous players who've done that superbly, they would be players like George Ambram, Torres Strait Islander, Lionel Morgan, Queenslander, of course, Lionel Williamson, Larry Corowa, Rick Walford, mentioned earlier, Bruce Larpa-Stewart, playing for Easts at a later age. Probably, though, the two players able to sort of ghost into gaps par excellence were Steve Renouf, the Pearl, and Dale Shearer. In another category, again, those players where there's kind of age, you know, geez, they seem to be sort of ageless. I understand that Cliff Lyons is still playing footy, I believe, but he would come into that category, as would, in terms of sort of kind of speculation about age, Preston Campbell, playing brilliant football at the moment. But the one who sort of almost defined that kind of category for whites was Chicka Ferguson himself. Toughness, well, Beetson, he's just the archetypal tough player. But we also had a player down here, and he's back in Queensland now, Sam Backer, who fitted that category as well. And I suppose if I had to throw one other player into it, that would have to be Ron Gibbs. You remember him playing for Manly and the number of times that Gibbs just hammering Raiders. But he was a wonderful, wonderful footballer. In summary then, I think probably in the contemporary game, in terms of the impact of Indigenous players in terms of rugby league and people who know rugby league or are interested in rugby league, the two most significant players impacting at the present are still Anthony Mundine in a lateral kind of way, and most recently, because I think he could be just the best of them all, depending on how his career goes in the coming years, and that's a fellow called Greg Inglis, who runs around in the centres or on the wing for Melbourne at the moment. And if he isn't in the top five rugby league players of all times in terms of potential talent and demonstrated talent on occasion, then I'm a poor judge. But then possibly I am a poor judge. Thanks very much.
Thanks, Dave. Come and join us here. We'll take... Anthony Mundine is a really interesting Australian phenomenon and cultural phenomenon. I followed his story very closely when I thought he bravely changed from rugby league to boxing. Within a couple of months from memory, he was NAIDOC Person of the Year. He was celebrated in the Indigenous community, but if you went to watch his fights in a Brisbane pub, the whole pub wanted Anthony Mundine's head punched in. You know, and what does that say about the community that we're living in? And, you know, it suggests to me that we've still got a long way to go. We haven't got a lot of time, so why don't we throw it straight open to questions now? Jay first.
A lot of times we sometimes shoot ourselves in the foot. So in the context of using race now... From the very start of this conversation, we probably should have spoke about race and to understand that we first have to understand the paradoxes and ambiguities that surround the issue of race for ourselves. And what we... In language, we commonly refer subtly that Aboriginal people are a different race. Now, scientifically, that's not the case at all. There's no such thing as a separate race. What there is, in fact, is separate cultures. And I think that's where we have to focus.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Oh. I'll be coming back to camp.
Can I, and it's probably putting Shay on the spot, but can I ask, given that, you know, Anthony Mundine has come up, is he an important element in white Australians getting the right kind of perspective on the black athlete? Is he an element in the, if I can say, the spectrum of black athletes that is helpful in the debates that are emerging now? How do you find his presence in the grand scheme of things?
In the community, there's no universal view on Anthony Mundine. You'll get Aboriginal people that love him, in particular young people who are aspiring to become boxers or athletes, because he is confrontational, in your face, and what that does is bring out a lot of negative and selective perceptions from people. But you'll get other mob that'll say, oh, he talks too much, you know, or he's become a Muslim, isn't he proud of his own heritage? So there's all of these things that go into what the community think of Anthony Mundine. I think exactly the same as you, John. What an inspiring move to go from rugby league, which he was a star, to becoming a world-class boxer. Who does that? You get now he's inspired such people like Saylor to go to change codes, and for now you'll see Carmichael Hunt changing codes. And this is how the young athlete now thinks that they want to be challenged once they have completed their task, or they feel that they've reached a peak or what they wanted to do in a particular sport. What's next? What's next for me? I need to be challenged.
It's interesting. I wrote about the story for the Australian press, admittedly inside sport, but there was more interest in that article from overseas, from England and Scotland, who were fascinated by the whole scenario. So I was then writing for the Scottish paper in particular, who didn't want 1,200 words. They wanted 4,500 words because they were so intrigued by it. So it certainly had resonance over there.
From my perspective, just in terms of the Mundine thing, because it is so fascinating, having taught in a subject called Indigenous Histories in Sport at Melbourne Uni, by far the person who you know created the most divisive kinds of comments was Mundine amongst the students. And when we sort of pared it down, I said, well, okay, well, let's look at this in an empirical way. I say Indigenous sports person doesn't drink, doesn't smoke, is highly religious, fit. What would you say? You'd go, fantastic. Then you put the word Anthony Mundine in it and it changes totally. Now, when you compare, and you can make a comparative analysis of Lionel Rose and Mundine on so many levels as a recording artist and as a world titled boxer and all the rest of it, and make those comparative analysis, the reasons why Lionel is now thought of, or, and this is a very generalistic thing, but is loved and respected and admired, is because he didn't speak out against whatever it might have been, whereas Mundine does. So he's got an opinion. That's what it basically boils down to. A lot of non-Indigenous Australians and Indigenous Australians don't like Mundine because he has an opinion. He doesn't know his place, and he's not about to play that role of the black fella that will sit in the corner and only be talked to when spoken to. He's going to tell you, and he's going to tell you what you don't want to hear. And for that creates the space where we then walk into to begin that discussion all over again. And I think that's the value of someone like Mundine.
This is Sean's big point, is the creation of the conversation, and that's what the sporting Indigenous involvement in visible elite professional sport has done. It's invited the conversation, it's invited us to talk about the issue, it's why we're here today.
That's why Pauline Hanson is so interesting. She acts like a social magnoplasm, yeah? Seriously, she draws the argument out. No longer can we sit on the fence. I don't agree with what she says, but it creates that space where we can start up. Sorry,
Dave.
It's interesting. You can't help but make the analogy with the earlier years of Muhammad Ali, where one of the things about boxing, especially, is of course bums on seats in the stadium. And there is no doubt that Mundine either advised or thinking his way through it, seeing that this is a profile, which is, you know, any individual can assume that profile, but he's assumed one aspect of the confrontation, is that it puts people through the turnstiles, and good luck to him. In the same way you say, you know, whatever your opportunity is to do that, one aspect, I'm sure, of the package that is Anthony Mundine at the moment is that it gets people riled in the same way. You look at the early footage of Ali, those early fights where you had black people furious with Ali for exactly what Sean was saying about getting out, you know, didn't know his place. I mean, classically, I'll stop, but if you can recall, there was one, in fact, it was the fight against Sonny Liston where you had people at the front furious with then sort of Cassius Clay, and one woman who looked to be black saying, you know, go on, Sonny, I think with a sort of screeching voice, you whop that nigger. That is to say, Ali was the nigger. Sonny Liston was not. He was one, you know, there was, you start to see, almost to start to understand, I think, aspects of different eras and associations, I suppose, for black people.
I wouldn't see Mundine as contrived as that in terms of developing a market, because had he wanted to do that, he would have stayed with Alan Jones or one of the promoters. I don't think it's about dollars and cents so much as self-determined. He and Coda, NASA, doing things on their own terms. Yeah, we've got a question?
Just stepping outside the football codes for one moment, I just wanted to mention another defining moment in Indigenous sport, and that was Cathy Freeman winning the 400 metres at the Sydney 2000 Olympic Games. I'm just wondering if you could make comments about what this means for Indigenous sports people and, you know, what can be achieved, particularly at the international level.
Jay?
Oh.
There's an
example. There is. The barrier with a lot of sports and athletics and union in particular and cricket is that the reason why AFL has such a great talent pool of Aboriginal players and all other players as well is because the financial barriers they're limited. All you do is you get a pair of boots. And you're right, might pay $100. And soccer for my 10-year-old, I pay $500 a year. Now you tell me how inclusive that is. So poor people are excluded straight away. And it's usually the poor people who are the most talented. Isn't it? Dean Zidane and the Algerian, Frenchman, stricken with poverty, one of the world's best ever players. Union is a different story. Cricket, you need your pads. So at the end of the day, payment for particular goods is a barrier for most sports. What people need to do is what's happening at the moment is engaging in communities. Athletic clubs need to go out and engage in communities so that they encourage people to go. So they've got a greater talent pool, and that helps. It depends who's championing the cause in a particular organisation.
Well, I've got a question here. Yeah.
Just got one question. I'm a great admirer of the Aboriginals, footballers and athletes in general. And one thing that stands out is their speed. Their speed off the mark. Probably the only white person as fast as Chris Judd of Carlton, the first 5 yards. He's very hard to beat. But all Aboriginals, they can weave and twist, keep their balance, but they are very fast. There must be something in it besides culture. It may be their physical bones, because I asked this question to the swimmer. There's very few black swimmers. And I asked the president of the swimming association, why haven't we got any champion black swimmers worldwide? Not just Australia. There is Olympic Games, Empire Games, there's very few blacks at the starting point. He said they can't, they sink. In other words, their bone structure, that's not funny, their bone structure, they start off as a handicap, they're below the water level. My question is, why are the Aboriginals fast and keep their balance? Is it because they're brought up running around hard grounds with bare feet? What is the answer?
Have you read Darwin's Athlete? Have you read Darwin's Athlete?
Yeah, I read it.
Yeah, I was just curious, that's all. No. Because, yeah, it's just, I suppose in terms of it, I'll answer this in a very indirect way. A colleague of mine, Indigenous colleague, Lenny Collard, a wonderful Noongar academic from Murdoch University, said, why is it that when you look at the Olympics, all the white fellas are doing the archery, the javelin and the shooting, yeah? Why is it the black fellas are always winning the running races, yeah? Maybe it's a cultural thing, who knows? But it's to go into those biologically determined sorts of characteristics is fraught with danger. Fraught with danger. And it's another 3-hour conversation in terms of those things.
Maybe at the AIS or somewhere like that.
Absolutely.
Look, I'd like to thank you all for coming today and being part of this Manning Clark House. Sorry, is there one more question? Sorry.
Well, yep. It's a couple of comments that you might like to comment on yourself.
Sure.
The first is that we meet here in a museum, the National Museum of Australia, with no Aborigine sitting on the board of this organisation. I don't know whether the same applies to Manning Clark House. Have you got an Indigenous representative on your board?
Not that I'm... No.
The second thing is in relation to the use of language when it comes to the description of Indigenous players. Mention was made of the Walpiru Wizard. Well, you know, the fact of the matter is that journalists, by and large, will err on the side of some fairly shabby alliteration, OK? So I really don't take a great deal of notice of that. And Dennis Cometti, I think, probably has something to answer for too on the matter of the. I think I've heard the term jarrah cane. Okay. I think that came from Dennis. Thirdly, Mr. Jarrah was brought initially to Melbourne by a Collingwood supporter, and I would argue that that goes some way towards squaring up for the Winmar matter back in... back in 93. Fourthly, one of the... you've probably guessed by now, I'm a Collingwood member. Fourthly, one of the things that's never mentioned about Mr. Dick... you will hear all these remarks about his athleticism, etc. But it's his sheer enthusiasm. You watch him whip that players along, and he does wonders for that side. And finally, why isn't the Northern Territory part of the national competition? And don't give me this spurious nonsense about finances. Could somebody answer that for me? Why isn't there a side from the NT in the national competition?
Yeah, Tassie too.
Well, that's a whole new debate. Look, I think I'm just going to finish it off. Look, I'd like to thank you all. Thank you for your comments. We've run out of time. Look, thank you so much for coming on behalf of Manning Clark House and the museum. Thank you for coming. Thank you very much to... And if you're interested in becoming a member of Manning Clark House, we've got some brochures from JMH and Johnette at the door here. Thank you so much to Dr. David Heaton, Dr. Sean Gorman and Shay Cockatoo Collins. Delighted that you could be with us today, and thanks very much.
The National Museum of Australia in Canberra explores what it means to be Australian
through our permanent galleries, exhibitions, public programs, and the National Historical Collection. Find out more about the museum at nma.gov.au or download more audio programs from nma.gov.au/audio.